when we're in urgency, we're in fight, flight, alarmed aloneness, or freeze, and our actions are coming from a place of panic and desperation, which robs us of our creativity. When we have a sense of being warmly received, of mattering, of loving the people that we're with, of having delight in them, then the nervous system shifts states to social engagement, where our immune systems start to function more fully, where our thoughts become more creative, where play becomes possible.
Hello and welcome to the Wild Minds podcast for people interested in health, nature-based therapy and learning. We explore cutting-edge approaches that help us improve our relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. My name is Marina Robb. I'm an author, entrepreneur, forest school, outdoor learning, and nature-based trainer and consultant, and pioneer in developing green programs for the health service in the UK. You're listening to episode 29. The radical act of warmth in an avoidant attachment culture. My guest today is neuroscience educator Sarah Payton, who is an author, an international constellations facilitator, certified trainer of nonviolent communication, and someone who has spent many years integrating constellation work, brain science, and the use of resonant language to heal trauma. She works with audiences internationally to create a compassionate understanding of the effects of relational trauma on the brain and teaches people how words change and heal us. Sarah speaks about both the personal and the systemic forces that lead to traumatization, including racism, patriarchy, gender oppression, capitalism, and colonialism. In this episode, though, I found the content incredibly powerful and very profound. We all feel distress and are triggered to defend ourselves, but when we, our body and brain, feel safe and loved, we're not only capable of healing, but also able to experience and offer joy, creativity, playfulness, have fun, and the energy and motivation to participate and cooperate in positive change for ourselves, others, and the world around us. I really hope you enjoy this podcast. Hi, Sarah, and welcome to the Wild Minds podcast. It's really exciting for me to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a lovely thing to be here with you.
I've told you before we went online that we always share a bit of gratitude. So I'd love to start. And then if you have anything you'd like to share, then that would be a wonderful place. Is that okay?
That's wonderful.
So actually, I've just come in from being with a group of teenagers and just sitting around a fire. So I have some gratitude for that feeling that I get when I can just be actually around a fire and we don't have to talk. And we just sit and hang out. So I'm well, for so many reasons, just grateful for fire.
Thank you. I'm grateful. I just came from a cello lesson and I decided to mostly take this week off, except for this podcast. Mostly I've taken this week off to play the cello. And so I'm just so I'm so grateful for the cello and for Bach.
Oh, wow. I can actually see that the listeners won't be able to see, but I can see your cello in the background. And it's amazing, isn't it? How, well, I mean, we're going to talk about a bit about nature, but also music. Isn't music just the most wonderful thing to soothe ourselves? Yeah. Well, as I said, I'm really grateful for you to come and share your time with me. And I'm excited to talk about so many things, actually. I've been sitting in bed reading your book and working through some of the exercises, and actually, you know, have actually found it quite moving and really taken me to some deep and reflective places. So I think there's so much I could ask you, but I guess one of the things that's been really present for me is this whole idea of this alarmed aloneness. Yeah. And this is something that you've, is this something that you've kind of come up with?
It's something that I've given the best name to that I can. It's because scientists talk about it all the time, but they use the word separation distress, which sounds so clinical.
Right.
And it doesn't do the thing that alarmed aloneness does in people's bodies. When you say, do you need a little acknowledgement of alarmed aloneness? How about some acknowledgement of decades of alarmed aloneness? And people are like, oh, yes. Yeah. Whereas if you say, do you need acknowledgement of decades of separation distress? People are like, no.
You know, because I've done quite a bit of, you know, reading and teaching even on what we often understand as those states of our nervous system, right? You know, like the flight, fear, freeze, and so on. But I've never heard of alarmed aloneness. And I wonder whether you would explain that, and that maybe will take us into your whole field of who knows where we'll go.
Yeah, of course. Well, so I was thinking a lot also about the nervous system and about fight flight. And I kept thinking how the terms fight flight kind of imply that either we're afraid or we're angry. And I had this experience, I mean, especially when my kid was little, my son, when he was little, he would run away in stores regularly. I mean, I knew all of the code words that come over the loudspeaker when your child is lost and they're sending employees to the doors to watch for kidnappers. And in the United States, it's often Peter Pan to the exits.
I've had that too, actually, with my daughter in my case.
Yeah. And so there would be in my body so much alarm, but it really wasn't. I mean, I was irritated that he was running away from me and I was scared for his safety, but there was something else that happened in my body that was not fear and not anger. It was this sense of something being torn away from me, and it was very alarming. Mm. And so I was thinking about fight, flight, fight, flight, fight, flight. And then I was like, I think we need to acknowledge that there's a third element of distress that puts people into stress states, that elevates heart rate, that elevates blood pressure, that decreases heart rate variability. And that it is a state of alarmed aloneness. And I was at the time looking very closely at Jaak Panksepp's work, who is an American neuroscientist who studied emotions in the 20th century and just started into the 21st century before he died. And he had what he called panic grief. And he was talking about how the word panic and panic attacks usually weren't about physical fear of safety. They were about being separated. And so I tried out panic grief for a while, but panic in English comes so close to like hysteria instead of to alarmed aloneness, even though Jaak meant for it to mean alarmed aloneness. So that's kind of, does it feel like I got people a sense now of what alarmed aloneness is? It's a state of being separated from someone or something that you love, and it's a distressing state, and you feel the distress in your body.
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense, but I guess because I'm new to it, I've been, you know, trying to sit with it and make sense of it in me and in my experience. And I know that you described it as it could be, you know, if you've had a divorce or you've lost somebody and someone's died and you have this experience of distress. But then I've also heard you talk about it in a kind of maybe more kind of a day-to-day way. And I've been thinking about it for myself and thinking that, you know, this, and it's been a theme actually of this year, where what's come up is that we now know globally that loneliness is the biggest killer, you know? So I was trying to make a link in a way between your work of this alarmed aloneness and this sense of global loneliness, and then my own personal sense of, I'd never would have called it alarmed aloneness, but now I'm recognizing it in me that it's a feeling of, I'm on my own here.
Yes.
That's really scary.
Yes. And when we experience this separation from others, the panic grief circuit, it actually, what happens is there's a spike of cortisol. And what is our greatest stress hormone as humans is cortisol. Our greatest stressor is that we're expecting ourselves to do it all by ourselves. And we're expected by our society to do it by ourselves. You know, grow up, be a big girl, don't cry. You know, you can do this on your own. You don't need me to help you. All the messages that we give each other about, you know, we shut children in their rooms to clean their rooms instead of doing it with them, you know. There's a way that I think the dominant culture says we're supposed to be alone, but our biology says we're not supposed to be alone. So it's a big chasm between what our bodies need and what our society says is the right thing to do.
So would you make that link then with this idea that one of the biggest killers is this loneliness?
Yeah.
Would you make that link?
Absolutely. I mean, right. They, you know, when people are talking about this, they hold up a heart that's been lonely, and they hold up a heart that's, you know, been a cigarette smoker for 30 years, and the damage is, you know, identical. I mean, that we get as much or more damage from loneliness as we do from cigarettes or a bad diet or anything else. We're truly meant to have not just to be in company, but to be in good company.
This is a call out to all you educators and health practitioners. Are you ready to revolutionize your career with outdoor learning? Don't let your practice become stale. You could be depriving your students or clients of life-changing outdoor experiences. Envision a world of possibilities, masterclasses, 120 instructional videos, and year-long session plans, all accessible at theoutdoorteacher.com/certificate. Enhance your career and embark on an extraordinary learning journey today. And lastly, if you're based in the UK, why not immerse yourself in nature with one of my transformative trainings in the beautiful landscapes of Sussex? Discover more about our in-person courses at circleofliferediscovery.com. I love the way you say that. Good, good company. And I think, you know, and I guess I'm thinking, isn't it that is hard when you don't trust people?
Yes, trauma has that impact. Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking about how you started out with your gratitude of being around the fire with people, with sweethearts. And
yes.
And we don't get to enjoy those fires if we're on the watch for somebody to hurt us. And if we've grown up in difficult family situations where there's been a lot of stress and where the grown-ups have been, or the older siblings have been scary or mean or have left us terribly alone, then we don't have any basis for expecting that the company will be good.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big thing then, because if we're, I mean, I'm saying we, like it's out there. If I, and I just know with so many people I work with that one of the things I'll say a lot of the time is that we just don't feel good enough, right? We generally don't feel good enough. And in a way, we are expecting people to behave, as you said, as we were shown in the past, right? So how can we, as parents, as practitioners, as fellow humans, how can we support each other then? Because I really do feel that, as you said, that our society is kind of growing us up to look after number one, and we don't really know how to have all these great friendships that easily, you know? So I mean, I know you've talked a lot about this resonant language and toolboxes and things like that, but maybe you'll draw on some of that to answer what I'm asking. But I am wondering, when we're coming from a place of deficit, then how can we heal and how can we support others? Because this is really important work, isn't it?
It's so important. And what's really sweet is that there's a starting point that's really simple that I can just describe right now. That's like, even before you do anything with language, the very first thing is to let yourself be delighted by another person. Just for a moment, it's the most protective thing we can do for each other in terms of depression, in terms of anxiety, is to just let ourselves be delighted by the other person's existence. Brings tears to my eyes because it's so lovely and sweet and simple, but not something that we take a couple breaths to do. It's like when you first come into contact with the people in your household in the morning when you wake up, what's it like if you take a couple breaths of delight? What's it like if you're like, ah, here's my partner. Ah, here's my child. Ah, here's my companion animal. Just like that place of warmth for each other is a very simple starting point. And it's something that's like a radical act in the face of a dominant culture of avoidant attachment. Because when we're avoidantly attached, we don't stop for even those couple of breaths of like, oh, I really like you.
I mean, that's already taken me to think about attachment, because I don't think many of us out here in the world really understand what attachment means. So it might be really helpful if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about these attachments. You said that the dominant culture was avoidant attachment.
Yeah.
And I've never heard of it. I've never heard someone say about the culture. I've heard it about, you know, parents or something.
Sure.
But could you speak to that?
I can. Most of the world kind of scores above 50% on secure attachment. So secure attachment means that you take a few moments for warmth and you're able to function. You know, you're not just disappearing into warmth or disappearing into emotion. You're both touching emotion and you're able to get done what needs to get done, and you get to have fun doing it, and it's relational and connected. And so secure attachment is when we bring the people who love us inside us and we carry them with us in our brains, and they say nice things to us during the day. They're encouraging, they're appreciative. You know, that inner voice is encouraging and appreciative and warm. And we kind of move into the world with an expectation, not that other people are going to take care of us, but rather that other people are interesting and that we will have moments of delight and that we can count on the folks that have our back. So that's secure attachment. Now, about 17% of the world shows up, this varies from country to country, but UK, US, 17% or so shows up as really solidly avoidantly attached. Avoidant attachment means that you don't expect to meet good folks in the world. You kind of just expect that you're on your own and that you need to be insulated and walk through the world with a layer of insulation, not expecting anything from anybody else. Now, what's so interesting is that when we are under stress, we move from secure attachment into avoidant attachment. That's the most common movement. So if we've got 50% of the world plus 17, which is mostly under stress, and we've got 17% of the world who's severely avoidantly attached, we're up at 67% of the world that's mostly avoidantly attached most of the time. We're trying to get things done in order to deal with the stress when the stress is about not being relationally connected. What we actually need to be doing is affiliating, connecting, taking care of each other, working together, pairing, but enjoying each other. You know, this is not an assignment of drudgery. This is an assignment of delight.
So if we've got a dominant culture and we're stressed, we're going to behave as if, well, we can't reach out, right?
Right.
That's
right.
A place where we can't reach out and we can't connect.
And where we just need to get more stuff done.
We just need to get more stuff done.
Yeah.
And if we're believing that the other person isn't going to meet our needs, then we're kind of in trouble, aren't we? We're going to be defensive. I feel like this is kind of like a spiral, which is really, really hard to get out of. And I know one of the reasons why I work outdoors and in the natural world is because I know both chemically that it supports a reduction in cortisol for a start, which then facilitates that ability to be more connected with each other when we're in an outdoor space. I mean, that's one of the kind of basics, but it feels more than that, because I really wanted to kind of chat with you about the possibility of this nature attachment. So we've got this human attachment, right? And we've got this whole, as you've spoken so wonderfully in your books as well, you know, just we are relational beings and how important that is. But from my experience, the humans are the tricky ones, right? Right. And you can go, if you have the opportunity to go to the natural world or little places, you know, little local places, you start to feel better.
And it's so interesting, isn't it, that nature causes our cortisol to drop and cortisol spikes when we have alarmed aloneness, and we're talking about nature attachment.
Yes.
Yes, we need the earth and the microbiome and the fungi and the trees and the flowers and the birds and the insects and the animals. We need them. That's a part of our being. And we're healed. I mean, you know, the forest bathing, you know, the increase in immune system response, all the good things that happen with lovely, lovely nature.
But do you see, though, a link between the kind of parenting that we might get as a child and the fact that so many people haven't had that relational, I'm going to use the word in inverted commas, my fingers are flying here, you know, of nature parenting, if you like. We haven't been in the company of nature. Do you see a link there?
Well, I grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska in the 1960s. So I grew up in the woods, and my family had really intense, as many families did in Alaska. People would move away from their families of origin when they had difficult families of origin and come up to the forest, up to the taiga. I believe that nature attachment is its own thing and can certainly help to compensate for difficult attachment experiences that people have in their families, but doesn't make up for it. You got to have, you know, it's really good and it's really important. And you also need the secure attachment with humans in order for the brain to get to that place where we can, you know, work together to save the climate, save the planet. Yeah. So it's its own really important thing, and it's not everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, would you say more about that then? Because you've talked about what we need. You just stepped into that thing about, well, what about our planet? You know, what about climate change and what we actually need to be healing, let's say, within ourselves in order to heal our relationship with others and then by extension, I think, the natural world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
It's a big subject, huh?
It's so big and it's so important and it's so beautiful. And we need each other so much. And we need these experiences of Yeah, we need these experiences of not just being in nature, not just feeling nature, but having the level of support for brain functioning that we can see what's happening with the planet over time, that we're not moving into denial. Because without the solid, secure attachment, if we're in avoidant attachment, we move into denial. We don't see. One of the things that avoidant attachment does is it knocks out the sense of future. So for everybody under stress, their sense of future is compromised. We need it's sort of this funny trail that we're following along. We need delight in one another in order for our brains to function well enough to be able to perceive the long-term time changes that we need to be able to perceive in order to go, oh gosh, we need some really big social changes here. Well, it's a funny place to start, but the place to start is with delight in one another.
Yeah, I mean, I often think about as the rise in what people are calling eco-anxiety, you know, being anxious of the fear of the destruction of our lives and our planet, that feels like it can feel to many people and to young people as well, that there's like this hole that there is no exit from. And yet I absolutely love and agree with you, this feeling of, well, we also need those moments of delight, those seeing what we're together and the hope that's in that, you know. Otherwise it can feel incredibly desperate. And I, again, I'm sort of picking up here that this is the same in a family. If you were in a family that was very dysfunctional and very distressed, it would be and is very hard to imagine something else if you haven't experienced it, I guess, as well as, because denial is a protector, I assume, right?
Oh yes. You know, it's part of the insulation that we put around ourselves when we believe we have to do it alone. So, boy, what a task for us. What a goal to have so much delight in each other that everybody's brains start working well enough to save this gorgeous, incredible, beautiful, and stunning, interconnected, complex being that we live on.
Is that a real driver for you in this healing work?
Oh yeah, it is. I love both. Well, more than anything, I love what happens to brains when they are loved.
Will you say more about that? Because again, I think that it's a lot of people listening won't understand what's happening in our bodies and our brains, and why you should say that focusing on delight is actually so valuable. Would you speak to that?
Yeah. As humans feel, I mean, it's true for other animals as well, any social animal. As we feel safe, then we move out of fight, flight, alarmed aloneness. I want to just also, you know, when we named, you know, eco-anxiety, I want to name the love that people have for the planet. I just, tears to my eyes, I just want to name how much people are like grieving, how much they love this incredible place we live on. So much love. And if that doesn't get named, and if that's not, if we just say it's just fear, we're knocking out an entire complex of capacity that we have as humans to love, to mourn, to rage, to play, to discover. And all those things are needed for remedying eco-anxiety and for saving the planet. We need these. We need this. Our complex capacity to figure out something to do together, set a goal, work together, look at what are doable steps towards our goal. And the thing is that it's so big, we can't do it alone. We can't make a little private blueprint a roadmap. We need to be making roadmaps with each other, and to be goofy along the way, and just loving the heck out of the planet and each other am I getting anywhere close to describing what you were hoping I would?
You're so sweet. You are. I mean, I'm stuck in the love at the moment, to be honest. I mean, I think it's really powerful because we're here holding the love that we feel for this earth and this planet and for people. And at the same time, because I know your work is, you've worked in prisons, you know the terror and the pain that exists as well. But here you are repeatedly saying, so we still have to find our way to love, right? And so I would love you to speak to that, in terms of the way you said, I mean, how do we find our ways to love ourselves and others? Because this is about healing, right?
Yeah, this is about healing, and it's about how do brains do their best work. So our brains are complex, and the safer that we feel, the more parts of the brain are contributing. As we move into urgency, we lose relationality. But the urgency is real. So we need to be holding the urgency together. And I think, some of the most complex and creative responses that have come from the folks who are working on the very edges of, trying to save the planet are come out of deep complexity. So, people forming chains of humans and blocking roads, that's a creative response. It's a creative and relational response. People taking, soup and throwing it on famous paintings. This is interesting. This is like awakens people. It's like, what's going on? It's like it's a creative and relational response. The folks who went and put all that, they covered the Prime Minister of Britain, they covered his house in fabric. Do you remember that when that was done?
It was quite
amazing. In response to him signing a whole bunch of lease agreements for oil exploration.
So these are the like an activist response, a big communal big response. And I think absolutely there's a place for that, but I'm also really asking about that place of the teacher, the professional, what can we do, in terms of some of the tools that you've written about and work with in terms of like resonant language and things like that. Could you speak to some of that? Because I think that it's like there's many ways, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's like we have to be on the streets. We have to be in policy. We have to be doing what we can in our day to day. And would you speak to some of that? Because I feel like there's this, I'd love to understand more how when we attend to our nervous systems, we can find our way back to love, as we were kind of saying, love of ourselves and each other. And then perhaps then have the ability to make those relationships so that we can go and do those bigger things,
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so if we start with the nervous system and the brain, when we're in urgency, we're in fight, flight, alarmed, aloneness, or freeze. And our actions are coming from a place of panic and desperation, which robs us of our creativity. When we have a sense of being warmly received, of mattering, of loving the people that we're with, of having delight in them, then the nervous system shifts states to social engagement, where our immune systems start to function more fully, where our thoughts become more creative, where play becomes possible, where we find it easier to affiliate with others and create community, where we naturally reach out to folks and connect with folks who have shared values and work together in whatever way, you know, perhaps teaching, perhaps policy creation, perhaps getting out the vote, perhaps doing these big creative political actions that are on the world media scene. All different ways of responding become more possible once we have a sense that it's safe to reach out to each other. And we create, as teachers with young people, we create that safety by really actually genuinely liking our students and enjoying them and taking moments for delight for each nervous system. Because when we do that, we're inviting each nervous system and each brain into social engagement, where creativity becomes possible. Yeah.
Is delight different to praise? Because I know a lot of people say, you know, praise, oh, well done, you've done that really well. They say, no, that's, I'm getting a really different sense from you, that it isn't the same, you know, as this genuine heartfelt response. I feel like that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Compared to this, you know, kind of, really, you just want to move on, you know, how people respond to people, and they just want them to move on by saying something nice to them.
Yeah,
there's a difference, isn't there?
There's such a difference, because that's, you know, evaluative and based on what somebody does, where delight is based on who somebody is, their being. And the question that we can ask ourselves and talk about, which is so radical, is how does your body warm or lift or soften when you come into contact with this person? What kind of metaphors come to mind, you know, when you come into contact with a person? Is it like a little firework going off behind your heart? Is it like frogs jumping into a pool? Is it like a leaf unfurling in the spring? You know, all of these things will happen. We'll have a different delight reaction to every single person. Every single person's snowflake nature will bring out a different delight in us. And if we begin to talk about it and notice the body sensations, just to take that moment of, like, you know, somebody says, how are you? And say, oh, my heart lifts when I see you. You know, it's a different response than what we're used to getting. We're telling people, you make a difference to me. You matter to me. You change me. And when we know that we can change one person, we start to have much more of a sense of agency in our world, that we can change more than one person.
And if I'm right, the metaphor, is that one of your resonant languages? Yeah. So is there, I don't know if I've got this right, is there like a toolbox of these resonant languages?
There is, because I was collecting all the different kinds of ways that we can. So what's so interesting about the left and the right hemisphere is that the right hemisphere is where relationality happens. It's where body sensations are noticed. It's not a hemisphere that has a ton of language capacity. So we have to talk to the right hemisphere to awaken the right hemisphere. And to-do lists don't awaken the right hemisphere, and praise doesn't awaken the right hemisphere. But letting somebody know that they've changed us, that awakens the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere likes that a lot. And that's the place where the neurons of secure attachment actually are developed. That's the place, it's between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, where where there's the most neural resilience and strength and growth that happens when we have real relationships with people. And that those tracts of neural tissue are what keep us calm and creative, even in the face of really big stuff. And also let us see the really big stuff. Because a lot of folks are walking around just trying to figure out how to get dinner on the table tonight and pay the rent or the mortgage. And that then keeps us from accessing our ability to see this beautiful planet and respond to this planet.
Yeah. It sounds like we need to slow down. It sounds like we, you know, like we need to slow down.
Yeah, slow down to speed up.
People are saying that, and the slow revolution, because actually, when I run around, I can't even notice the flower. I can't notice the cloud that's moving or the smell, you know. And I think, you know, when I think of children and my childhood, but children, you know, generally, I think it's the time, isn't it? The time they always say, "Oh, I love playing outside because I have time and space." Mm. And I think part of the time is that they're seeing adults for the first time, being a bit silly,
yeah,
a bit having fun, and they're slowing down as well. And so, because you talk about, you know, regulation and co-regulation, and there's something in that, isn't there? If the adult is stressed out, then they're certainly not giving these cues that you speak of, you know, to the child, and they're not being met in any sense of delight or anything else, right? Yeah. I think it's so important, all these things. I really do, and I wish that there was a kit when you become a parent or even a teacher, you know, where you could actually pick up this stuff and do it for others, but do it for yourself, right? Because we've got to do it for ourselves too.
Yeah, we've got to do it for each other.
Yeah, we got to do it for each other.
We gotta love all the parents that we know, so that they get to stop and have some delight in their kids. Yeah,
it's true, but it's hard. I say this in different times. It's hard to kind of be generous with love that you might have when you're empty.
Yeah,
when you're running on empty, isn't it? And there's something,
and all our beloved parents are out there running on empty.
Yeah.
So how are they going to find the juice to stop and tell their kids, when I see you, it's every day. When I see you, my heart swirls.
Mm. Yeah. And to do it genuinely though, because there's something, you know, I could take the script, I could read and repeat what you said, but to do it genuinely, I have to slow down, don't I? I have to kind of stop and feel it to express it.
Yeah.
So the message is definitely slow down. It's always about slowing down, I guess. and I guess, to finish the conversation, is there anything that you would suggest that people could do for themselves, I suppose, like, I mean, you know, we have talked about very, you know, about the planet, but what, there are some kind of things that you would suggest that we could do to look after ourselves, whether that's about our body as well, you know, but is there anything there that you feel you would want to share?
One of the things we can do, I wrote the book you were reading so that people would be able to, the Your Resonant Self book, so that people would be able to do something that would be a little bit of a bridge between believing we have to do it ourselves and kind of starting to reach out for connection with others. Our tender, beautiful hearts. I was just hit by a wave of acknowledgement of how vulnerable we are, even in our adult friendships, how much we just need to be, you know, loved and cared for. So there's on my website, there's a button. If you go to sarahpayton.com, there's a button that says Start Healing Now that lets people receive a whole series of guided meditations that we can. So those, that's the sort of thing we can do on our own, guided meditations, journaling where you write letters to yourself of appreciation and sweetness and delight. And one of the practices I enjoy is, I can't do it if I'm empty, but if somebody else has done a little bit of filling of my tanks, I can wake up in the morning and greet Sarah and say, "Oh, I'm so happy you're awake. Welcome to the world." You know, a kind of a practice of self-warmth is quite something.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you for your warmth and your kindness and all the work that you're doing for us all. I really appreciate you.
I'm grateful. I'm grateful for you and your voice in the world and for working with this wonderful kids and sitting in circle with them.
Thanks again for speaking to me, Sarah. I feel I've been invited to be kind to myself and gentle and warm with my own vulnerable parts, especially the ones that have not really been cared for. Do remember to go to our show notes to link to Sarah's work and download her free resources by clicking the button Start Healing Now, as well as getting all the other behind-the-scenes content. If you're enjoying the Wild Mind podcast, please help share it with others. Join me next week for episode 30, when I explore our basic emotional systems and share a few more ideas to support healing ourselves. This is for our own personal development, as well as for the work we do as parents, facilitators, and practitioners. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Wild Minds podcast. If you enjoyed it and want to help support this podcast, please subscribe, share, and leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Your review will help others find the show. To stay updated with the Wild Minds podcast and get all the behind-the-scenes content, you can visit theoutdoorteacher.com or follow me on Facebook at The Outdoor Teacher UK and LinkedIn, Marina Robb. The music was written and performed by Jeff Robb. See you next week, same time, same place. Are you curious about the guitar music in my podcast? It's actually my husband, Jeff Robb. He's taking his woodland-inspired show, The Music of Trees, on tour in England and Wales this May, June and July. Get tickets at jeffrobb.com/shows.